Trump Unfiltered, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. President-elect Trump is known for his off-the-cuff communication style that could become a foreign policy problem once he's in office, unless he starts paying attention to career diplomats.
These are very talented people. They'll be loyal to him. They'll want him to succeed, but he's going to have to listen to them.
Also today, Pat Fornes' father was a launch officer during the Cuban Missile Crisis. That inspired her to follow in his footsteps.
Watching Dad, I knew with hard work, I could make that happen.
Find out if she did. Plus, Gabriel Garcia Marquez let Fidel Castro edit his writing. And if a passage involved a gun, Castro would say,
"Well, no, that's impossible, because that type of gun wouldn't be used in that way."
Those stories today here on The World. Thank you for being with us. A lot to get to this Friday, everything from post-election surprises in The Gambia to the enduring friendship between Colombian writer Gabriel Garcia Marquez and the late Fidel Castro. And we start with Castro today, revisiting some Cold War history in which he played a major role. 54 years ago, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, the United States came closer to nuclear war than it ever has.
The U.S. threw up a steel fence, prepared to stop any vessel carrying materials of war. Cuba became the focus of world attention. Here centered the most critical threat of global war since the surrender of Germany 17 years ago.
For 13 days in October 1962, Soviet and American missiles were on high alert, ready to launch on a moment's notice, just waiting for orders from Khrushchev and Kennedy. We wanted to look back at that time through the eyes of men and women who saw America's nuclear forces evolve. The World's Daniel Gross has our story.
When Joe Andrew was a kid, he loved learning about rockets.
I knew about almost every rocket that the United States had at the time. We were hot in the late 50s to get into space because Sputnik, you know, was up there. Oh, that was just a crushing blow to young fellows like me because we had to keep up with those Russians.
Andrew's imagination may have been in outer space, but the world around him had more immediate concerns.
We knew that if you saw a big flash, don't look at it because it would burn your eyes. We had heard about atom bombs ever since I was about 5 years old. I remember very well as a youngster seeing pictures of the first H-bomb.
Andrew is a retired chief master sergeant in the U.S. Air Force, and his childhood interests served him well. In 1959, he started a decades-long career as a missileer, which is what insiders call people who work with nuclear weapons. Somehow it didn't faze him that his job was part of a showdown between two superpowers.
It was something that was just a part of life. It was like the traffic's bad on I-93. They had crises about every 2 months or so, and then things would get tense.
In 1962, a different scale of crisis began. Andrew was in Montana working with Minuteman missiles at Malmstrom Air Force Base. So imagine, he learns on the news that the Soviet Union was installing nuclear missiles in Cuba, just 90 miles south of Miami.
I go to bed at night now with the president's words ringing in my ears, and I'm thinking, you know, I don't know. This is like in the science fiction stories. I don't know what the world's going to be like when I wake up in the morning.
As a missileer, Andrew was put on six-ring alert. This meant that even in the middle of the night, he had to be ready to pick up the phone within six rings. He was determined that if the call came, he'd be ready.
My first feeling on the next morning was relief that I woke up in bed and was able to shave, put on a uniform.
Andrew drove to work while it was still dark and arrived at an Air Force hangar. To his surprise, it was empty.
There weren't any airplanes out there. Now, on a normal day, there were hundreds of airplanes. The planes have all dispersed. They didn't want the planes to be all in one spot in case a nuclear weapon landed there and destroyed Malmstrom. It was like, wait a minute, everyone left and we're still here.
It was time for the missileers to get to work.
It was just the sun coming up, utter silence on the base. They loaded us up with the warhead in our trailer truck, and we trucked it out to the missile site we were assigned to.
You actually drove in the back of your truck, you actually had a warhead.
You bet.
And you were just driving it around.
Yeah, regular, just like a little 18-wheeler, driving it around in the back of the truck.
Basically, the team would drive that truck right on top of each missile silo. And then they could lower each warhead through a hole in the truck bed, directly onto the tip of a Minuteman missile. And while Andrew and his colleagues drove around Montana, they were glued to the radio.
The United States arrived at the decision for an arms blockade after studying reconnaissance photographs made with high-powered cameras from planes flying several miles from the Cuban coast.
They knew that they were part of something historic and dangerous.
I remember my thought was, as long as they're talking, as long as there were words being exchanged between Khrushchev and Kennedy, there's unlikely to be a nuclear strike.
These days, when we talk about nuclear weapons, they seem distant and impersonal. But hundreds of men like Joe Andrew helped assemble, aim, and protect nuclear warheads. They were deep in the heart of America, but in a sense, they were on the front lines. Of course, this isn't just a story about the men who ran American missile silos in the 1960s. It's also a story about the men and women who lived with the consequences. When the Cuban crisis started in 1962, a woman named Jerry Fornes was listening to news reports too. Fornes was on the home front in Ohio. Her husband was a missile launch officer.
I remember that the day it happened, they called everybody to work. Everybody went on alert. Everybody left the house, you know, and went to the flight line.
Jerry Fornes is 89 years old. But back then, she lived in a neighborhood populated by Air Force families. And because they were the oldest family around, military wives looked up to her. At the time, the Air Force was run by men. Women weren't even allowed to become missile officers.
And the house was suddenly full of young women who were really nervous and anxious and not knowing what to do. And I said, well, I think we ought to play bridge.
So while politicians were scrambling to diffuse tensions between Washington and Moscow, Fornes was trying to diffuse tension in her own living room. That's another aspect of nuclear weapons that doesn't always make news headlines. The sense of insecurity affects everyone. It becomes a part of the national psyche. And it forces ordinary people to become leaders in a way. There was a period when Jerry Fornes didn't know where her husband was or what he was doing.
So I didn't see him for 5 days. He was very busy. It was part of the game, you know, part of the job.
The Cuban crisis ended after a flurry of high-stakes diplomacy when Khrushchev finally agreed to withdraw missiles from Cuba. But Joe Andrew remembers that from that day forward, his job never lost the sense of urgency. That helps explain why the anxiety of the Cold War was passed down to future generations.
We never went back to daily life. All we knew about operating and maintaining Minuteman was this panic, dash, six-ring alerts and things like that. That sort of concept of operating was now instilled in us, and we never got to anything we would call a civilized way to do business.
But other things did change, like the rule that only men could serve in the Air Force.
I'm Pat Fornes. I'm a retired Air Force colonel. And during my career, I was a weapons controller and then was lucky enough to become a missile launch officer.
Colonel Fornes is the daughter of Jerry Fornes, who played bridge with all those military wives at the height of the Cuban crisis. And when Colonel Fornes was a kid, she used to watch her father study missile launch procedures. His partner would come by the house, and together, the two men would go through the protocol of launching a nuclear weapon.
They were downstairs in Dad's study, and they were sitting side by side like they would be sitting in the launch capsule. And they'd have their tech data both open and then going through the procedures together. And it was a good thing to see as a sixth and seventh grader that life means doing your job and preparing and studying and keeping at it.
Those practice sessions made a big impression on Fornes. In high school, she was one of the first women to join the Reserve Officer Training Corps, or ROTC. She started out as support staff for male pilots. But then in 1977, she read that the role of missile launch officer was going to open to women. That same day, she called the personnel office and asked for a transfer.
Obviously, watching Dad, I knew with hard work, I could make that happen. So I was looking forward to being the operator, the pointy end, the one responsible for executing the mission rather than being a support team.
The Air Force was not especially welcoming to women back then. The performance of female officers was scrutinized for any sign that they didn't measure up to their male counterparts. Once, Forns attended a party with her colleagues and their families.
And a squadron commander's wife walked up to me and told me that nobody wanted me here, and I better behave myself. So I was pretty speechless for a time, and I said, well, ma'am, I have no intention of doing anything but good work while I'm here. You know, I didn't lose my temper, and I got out of the situation without demeaning myself at all. And I guess if they go low, you go high. Thank you, Michelle Obama.
For a long time, the younger Forns didn't have many female colleagues, so she mostly kept her challenges to herself.
It was just one more thing I had to do to get on with being a good missileer. Just a second. Do you recall me telling you that story, Mom?
You did not tell me that story.
I did not tell Mom that story.
That would have gone down
your shoulder. Yeah. Mom said she would have taken care of her.
The two generations of the Forns family witnessed the evolution of America's nuclear forces. When politicians gave speeches about deterrence and mutually assured destruction, these were the women and men behind the scenes. Here's Jerry Forns again, talking about her daughter, Pat.
And, you know, when you're up against so much prejudice, and there was so much prejudice against women, you have to be twice as good as a man, and you've got to be twice as good a leader as a man would be. She was, and she is.
It's no longer unusual for a woman to lead in the nuclear field, thanks in large part to women like Pat Forns. In 1993, while the Cold War was coming to an end, Forns was promoted to Missile Squadron Commander. In fact, she was promoted to lead the very same missile squadron that her father had commanded. I asked mother and daughter about their memories of that day.
She was going to become the first female missile squadron commander in the history of the Air Force. And we were at the old base, and it was familiar, and it was wonderful, and my entire family was there. And I'm afraid I was crying so hard I don't remember what it looked like. It was just a wonderful day.
It was a proud moment for me, and it reminded me of once again, the importance of sticking with it, moving forward. Relies on each of us doing our part. We stand on our sister's shoulders as we go forward.
I asked Forns how she managed to work every day with the most destructive technologies ever created. She said that paradoxically, destructive weapons seemed to help keep the peace. So far, no country has wanted to fire the first shot. I asked Joe Andrew, the first missileer that I spoke with, the same question. He said that even in a job with huge implications, he had to think small.
What your world tends to shrink to in situations like that is your little part of it. And I thought, my little part is not going to fail. If the mission goes awry, it shall not be because my part failed. My part is going to work.
This is really what it means to be a missileer. You're always ready to use a weapon that you hope your country will never need. For The World, I'm Daniel Gross.
Daniel's report is part of our Nuclear Family Project, stories about the human relationships that kept us safe in the atomic age. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, and it is time to tell you about another unexpected result at the polls. In terms of size, the Gambia doesn't come close to the U.S., but like the U.S., few thought there was any chance of an upset in elections held yesterday in the Gambia. So much for experts. Again, incumbent President Yahya Jammeh, in office for 22 years, ended up losing at the polls, and the West African nation is now set for a rare handover of power. Jeffrey Smith is executive director for Vanguard Africa. That's a U.S.-based group that worked with Gambia's opposition coalition. What are you hearing from the Gambia, how tense this situation is right now, and what happens next?
It's still a tense situation. We're not out of the woods yet. People are in the streets. They're celebrating. You know, before the elections, Yahya Jammeh actually made a statement saying he would not tolerate public demonstrations in the aftermath of the election. But he did not ban victory celebrations. And that is certainly what is happening in the Gambia right now. I've spoken to a number of people in the country by satellite phone because the telecom infrastructure is still down, which was shut down by the authorities in the lead up to the elections, and people are euphoric. I am very optimistic that Gambia is going to be set on a democratic path.
So how did this happen?
There was really an unprecedented groundswell of support for the opposition for the first time in the country's history. The opposition, its many different leaders and political parties, actually came together and united behind one single candidate, which was both monumental, unprecedented, and hugely empowering and a significant factor for why we saw the result that we did. And secondly, typically in the Gambia, the heavy-handedness and the repression enforced and exhibited by the government has stifled dissent and criticism and political activity in the past. This time around, it actually energized people and got them out into the streets and advocating for democratic reforms in the country.
So just how oppressive a leader has Yahya Jammeh been in the Gambia?
Well, the Gambia is really the most repressive dictatorship that most people have never heard of. It's become a country known for enforced disappearances, for torture, and for massive widespread human rights violations. For instance, just this year, in the lead up to elections, three opposition supporters, one a very prominent youth leader of one of the main opposition parties, was actually tortured to death while in state custody.
It was Adama Barrow of the United Democratic Party who defeated Jammeh. Will Jammeh give up power easily?
Against all odds, it does seem to be going that way. I think there was so much support and people were so willing to quite literally put their lives on the line to go out and vote yesterday, late into the day, to vote this man out of power, that I think it just became apparent both to Jammeh himself very clearly, because he actually, it's being reported that he has conceded that he is meeting with President-elect Barrow. And I think regional leaders in West Africa had grown tired of Jammeh's act. He really is a black eye on a region that is otherwise performing very well in terms of advancing democracy.
So your organization, Jeffrey, Vanguard Africa, is described as a nonprofit organization providing support to ethical political leaders to boost their campaigns. But you're effectively part of the opposition. And I'm just wondering, after all the talk of outside actors meddling in the U.S. elections, do you feel like you were meddling in the Gambian election?
So often in these repressive environments, Gambia being a very good example, there are myriad obstacles and highly entrenched dictatorships by virtue of the fact that they've been in power for decades at a time and dip their hands into state coffers. They have the money, they have the resources to stay in office. So what we're trying to do is really work with those democratic underdogs, work with those pro-reform leaders, giving them the expertise, the technical know-how, and most importantly, showing them the solidarity that is so often lacking, which gives them courage to really stick their necks out and challenge these highly abusive governments.
I gather that solidarity has turned into an offer for honorary citizenship for you in the Gambia. Are you going to take it?
I've been working on Gambian human rights issues for a number of years, and I will happily take that, and I'm looking forward to celebrating with my Gambian friends when the inauguration happens. It's a day we've all been looking forward to for so long.
Jeffrey Smith is Executive Director for Vanguard Africa. Thanks so much for your time, Jeffrey.
All right, thank you so much.
From one election that's over to another that's coming up, this weekend Italians head to the polls. They're voting in a referendum which would make big changes to their country's constitution. Supporters say it would help cut through Italy's infamous bureaucratic red tape and make economic reforms easier to get through parliament. My BBC colleague Paul Moss took the pulse of Italians in the city of Turin.
Se tu vuoi.
Right now, Italy's government is desperately trying to persuade its own voters that the constitutional changes it wants should be supported in the referendum it's holding on Sunday. What's being proposed in Sunday's referendum is that Italy's upper house, the Senate, should no longer have the same ability to thwart the will of the lower house. More power for Parliament to introduce the kind of economic, business and employment reforms that this country desperately needs, according to Stefano Russo, a Turin spokesman for Italy's ruling Democratic Party.
In order to make Italy more modern, more suitable to new business, new jobs, we need also to have a system of decision that is more simple, more clear. If the yes will prevail, we will launch a step in a more general reform process to solve the main problem of Italy.
And Turin certainly does have a few problems that need solving. Once upon a time, this city embodied Italy's success. Its car industry, most famously Fiat, was part of a post-war boom. But those days are long gone. Fiat doesn't employ so many people here nowadays. So you might think that Sunday's referendum would be a done deal, that a population desperate for change would support proposals to streamline the political system. But all the latest polls show that the No campaign is in the lead, and commentators will tell you that's partly because Italians aren't really voting on the issue at stake.
People that will vote no, they will make this choice to fire the Prime Minister. It's a vote not on the reform.
Maurizio Molinari is editor-in-chief of La Stampa newspaper, which has its headquarters in Turin. He sees an anti-government, anti-establishment tendency at work here.
It is so strong. The lack of jobs, the lack of prosperity, and the lack of hope. They may vote against the referendum because it was the government that proposed it. They want to vote against the government.
Buonasera, io sono Paola.
Nice to meet you, Paola.
Camilla.
I got a taste of that political disenchantment when I visited the home of Paola Massera, a local woman who works in PR, and who was having some people over to discuss what to do come Sunday's vote.
No, che tipo di te? No, guarda, non è che c'è niente di...
Sara is a strident member of the No camp.
Well, I think that if the yes wins, the next government would have so much power. That was how our previous dictatorship began. Mussolini, Hitler.
Well, Paola herself isn't convinced that the constitutional changes are worth supporting.
The constitution was written by very informed and very deep politicians. Our government is people who are not that well informed and educated, I think. They can tell us anything. And I don't know if this is true or not. I do not know.
Paola Massera ending that report by my BBC colleague, Paul Moss, in Turin, Italy. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. Fred is a North Carolina voter who wants undocumented immigrants deported.
Donald Trump won, so I'm happy about it.
But his wife, Elena, isn't happy.
Pues realmente no me agrada.
She was once undocumented, and some of her relatives could still be deported.
We don't talk about this at dinner.
Meet Fred and Elena ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Morning, noon, and night. It seems that President-elect Donald Trump is always on Twitter, always ready to give his opinion or his advice. In January, Trump becomes America's commander-in-chief, but also its top diplomat, and he'll assume control of the president's official Twitter account, at POTUS. So how will diplomacy fare? Nicholas Burns is a former U.S. ambassador to NATO. I asked if he thinks that once Trump assumes office, he will keep tweeting.
He obviously believes in the power of Twitter because he said publicly it's his chance to reach 20, 25 million people and not have to do that through you guys in the media. And so I think he feels it's an advantage for him. It's a way to get his message out. I would expect a President Trump to continue to be on Twitter.
So you're a former diplomat, Nick Burns. You had to work with all sorts of people. What do you think is the best way to deal with somebody like Donald Trump on a diplomatic level, online, offline, or in person?
Well, I think to obviously listen carefully to him. I think he's going to have to be disciplined and restrained. Diplomacy is not about saying nice things to people. Diplomacy is about advancing a country's interests. And sometimes that means standing up to that country. So we had this extraordinary example just the other day of President-elect Trump calling the Prime Minister of Pakistan. And the Pakistanis released the transcript of the call. And it was Donald Trump saying all sorts of very flattering things to the Pakistani Prime Minister, when in fact, we have a very difficult relationship. Pakistan's not been a good friend to the United States. It's been harboring terrorist groups. Trump on the campaign trail was exceedingly critical, but he failed to deliver that message. And so I think he's going to have to adjust his style. He's going to have to learn how to deliver a tough message. One would not have thought that would be a problem for Donald Trump. But now that he's president-elect, he seems in a way to think that diplomacy is just saying nice things. It's not. It's delivering tough message. It's getting our way in the world.
You know, one of the things that we kept hearing from the campaign trail is people like the way Trump speaks, casually, like one of them. I'm just wondering, are there certain tactics that Trump has used that you find refreshing, like his bluntness, or things that you feel like maybe you've even learned from him that you may incorporate in the classes you teach?
Well, I did not support Donald Trump during the campaign. I supported Hillary Clinton. But you have to respect and admire his ability to communicate with people. He's able to distill complex subjects into very small sound bites. His entire campaign was understood by every single potential voter, Democrat, Republican, or Independent. Make America great again. Four words. And I do think he has a talent for that. Now, as president, that could be a great advantage to Donald Trump and for the United States. He could reach, for instance, beyond the authoritarian governments of Russia and China, perhaps to reach the people of those countries through Twitter, through Facebook. And that might be a real advantage for the United States in our foreign policy and in what we're trying to do, for instance, in promoting human rights, in appealing to these authoritarian governments to give a greater measure of freedom to their populations. Ronald Reagan had this gift. John F. Kennedy had this gift. Some of our very successful presidents have been great communicators. I think Trump has that promise and capacity. And if I were Donald Trump or his advisors, I certainly want to make that a real priority for his first months in office.
So, Harvard Professor Burns, what's the one piece of diplomatic advice you would have for Trump as he prepares to take office?
I think Donald Trump needs to realize that the greatest power differential that gives the American people an advantage overseas are our alliances, our NATO alliance in Europe, our alliance militarily with Japan and South Korea. And Donald Trump spent the entire campaign denigrating these allies, suggesting that these alliances were obsolete and perhaps even irrelevant. That would be a grave mistake, because what we have in the world are countries willing to defend us, willing to rally around us. So I think he needs to build up these alliances with Prime Minister Abe and the new South Korean president in the future, and certainly with Chancellor Angela Merkel and Prime Minister Theresa May in Europe. And I hope that Donald Trump will not put his weight behind the right-wing populists who are seeking to undermine democratic regimes in Europe. That's why his public support for Nigel Farage, who led the British campaign to leave the European Union, was such a grave mistake of judgment.
Nicholas Burns is a former U.S. ambassador to NATO. He's now a professor at Harvard. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco.
One more little note here on the president-elect's online habits. It turns out more than a few people have no idea what Trump's been saying on Twitter. That's because they've been blocked from even seeing his tweets, like 16-year-old Antonio Del Otero. He's a junior at Huron High School in Detroit, Michigan, and a couple of months ago, he tweeted something kind of mean to Trump.
I deleted the tweet now because the hate I got from it, from all his supporters, was just a little annoying. But it was basically, I called him a reject Cheeto.
A reject Cheeto. That tweet got a lot of likes. And then an hour later, when Antonio tried to take a look at Donald Trump's Twitter profile, he realized he was blocked.
I didn't believe it at first at all. I was kind of in shock. I was at school when I saw that, and I just kind of showed everyone. We all laughed about it, but I didn't know what to think of it. I didn't believe it.
Antonio says he doubts that he will also be blocked from the POTUS account, but he doesn't intend to follow Trump on Twitter again anyway. Still, this episode inspired Antonio, who is a member of the student council, to consider a new career path.
I've always wanted to be a doctor, but over this past year, with this election, I've seen how ugly and messy politics are. And when I'm older, if I could try and change that and be some sort of good leader or good politician, I'd like to do that.
His name is Antonio Del Otero. Remember it. The recent election has left many Americans split on big issues like the economy, women's rights, and immigration. And sometimes those divisions exist within families. Take the Bronsons. They're from Raleigh, North Carolina. And the world's Jasmine Garsd recently met them.
It's nearly impossible to find Fred Bronson's house at night. It's right outside of Raleigh in a suburban neighborhood dotted with bodegas and small restaurants. The road is bumpy and it's pitch dark.
Hello?
Fred steps out. He's a large man dressed in an old t-shirt, head wrapped in a Confederate flag bandana.
Hi.
Hi. How you doing?
Good. How are you?
His small wooden house is cluttered with books and memorabilia. We sit on the couch. Fred has a southern drawl, but he's actually from New York's Adirondacks. He left when he lost his job at a wire mill. It was when a lot of work dried up in the area.
The wire mill shut down and moved down south. Revere Copper moved out, Prowler Trailer moved out, Griffiths Air Force Base shut down, and Ethan Allen Furniture Factory moved out. So basically, you know, there wasn't much work.
He came to North Carolina. Warm weather. Plenty of work.
You could open up the newspaper, get the newspaper, and there was probably 20 pages of ads. of, you know, jobs. I mean, you had your pick, and I was making really good money back in 1990.
He got a nice house for his family.
It was up on top of a hill. It had two bedrooms upstairs, two bedrooms downstairs, den, kitchen, living room. It was nice. You know, nice long driveway. But, you know, I mean, you know, shit happens and you lose it.
It was 2007, the Great Recession.
Everything went dead.
But Fred says it wasn't just the economy.
You know, when you got 300,000 illegals up here that are willing to work for $9 an hour, $8 an hour, $10 an hour, then we start losing our jobs.
Between 1990 and 2000, North Carolina's Latino, mostly foreign-born population grew by about 400%. With lots of competition for work in places like Los Angeles and New York, many immigrants saw opportunity in America's South.
The gates just opened up, and nobody seemed to stop them.
Around that time, Fred says he asked his boss for a raise.
I went and talked to the president of the company one time, and he's sitting there, and we just, you know, talking about the raises, and he goes, "Well, listen, I have four other people come in now. I'm going to tell you the same thing I told them. You want a raise? They're hiring down the street, because I can hire three illegals for what I'm paying you right now."
Did you ever think of changing careers?
To what? I'm 63 years old.
Like the majority of North Carolina voters, Fred was pleased when Donald Trump won, promising to stop illegal immigration and deport millions. He's hoping fewer undocumented immigrants will mean more work for him.
The ones that are here, the children that were born here, he probably can't do nothing about.
But he says if there's a crackdown on businesses that hire undocumented immigrants, that'll push people out.
If you don't have a place to work, they'll go home.
You might think Fred is kind of a stereotype, someone easy to figure out. And then you meet his wife.
Hola.
Hola.
This is Elena. She's from Guanajuato, Mexico. She came here for work, and when she met Fred, she was undocumented. She'd overstayed her visa. She has a work permit now and cleans hotels. She laughs at the surprised look on my face. They are such an unlikely couple.
Me gusta mucho hablar.
They've been married for about 8 years. They have a son. Elena's family is mostly undocumented. Her father, who is not a citizen, lives with them. Elena does not like the new president.
Pues realmente no me agrada. La forma en que él se expresa de la gente hispana, no.
I really don't like him, she says. The way he talks about Hispanic people, no. And he wants to build that wall? No, I don't like that.
We don't talk about this at dinner. You know, but, you know, in this house, my views are my views, her views are her views. When we're together, we respect each other's views.
Sí, para mí es un buen esposo.
He's a good husband, Elena says.
You love me.
This is hardly the only American family split by the elections, but it is an extreme case. Fred is thrilled, while his wife and her family worry about deportations. Fred doesn't think that's going to happen. He just feels there's a bigger issue at hand.
We've lost who we were. We've become complacent as Americans. You know, we've had a good, you know, this and that. We're used to people, you know, we're used to having money. We're used to this and that. Well, you know, sitting there for some reason, we seem to have lost who we were. We lost where we came from.
Who are we?
Well, we were a strong nation once.
But Elena worries about what her future is in that strong country Fred wants back. For the World, Jasmine Garst, Raleigh, North Carolina.
Remember the big Volkswagen diesel scandal? VW hopes you don't. The company that got caught cheating on the emission controls for its diesel cars now says its future is in electric vehicles. And VW isn't the only one souring on diesel. So are four world capitals: Madrid, Athens, Paris, and Mexico City. This week, the mayors of those cities announced that they're going to ban diesel vehicles, cars, and trucks from their roads within 10 years. Sarah Kohlenbrander has been following the new announcement. She's researcher at the International Institute for Environment and Development in London.
Ironically, diesel was originally encouraged because it was believed to be better for the environment than for petrol, but new evidence has emerged about some of the health costs. In particular, diesel tends to produce nitrous oxides and tiny particulates that can get deep into the cells of the lung. Both of these can cause asthma for those who are already suffering from respiratory diseases. And they can also cause lung cancers in the long term.
So there are a lot of diesel vehicles all over the world, not that many in the United States for personal use. How is a plan going to work in these very big cities?
Well, I think the important thing to understand is that no one is going to have to give up their diesel car or diesel truck immediately. The plans are being phased in over 9 years, so that when people who are getting rid of their car or truck anyway go to buy a new one, they'll be required to buy a cleaner one at that point. For example, hybrid cars, which are much lower in terms of pollution.
Hybrid and also electric? Or will electric vehicles be kind of promoted as an alternative, as a replacement for the diesel?
Absolutely. But the quality of electric vehicles and their impacts on the environment and on public health do depend on what kind of fuels are used to generate electricity. If electricity is generated from coal, well, coal-fired power plants produce an awful lot of air pollution as well.
I imagine commerce is pretty concerned about this because a lot of big trucks use diesel. It provides fast, big bursts of energy. What would replace the trucks that run on diesel?
There are increasing number of models available that can run on different fuels for the same cost. And now that these cities are putting in these policies, there's going to be even more of an incentive for the manufacturers to accelerate the scaling up of these new models.
Yeah, so if this is supposed to be kind of locked in by 2025, how soon do you think we're going to see the benefits?
I expect we would start seeing the benefits quite quickly, within a few years at most. People buying cars and buying trucks will have to make these investments in cleaner options over the next few years. And so we'll see very quick improvements in the levels of pollution in these cities.
Right. So you'd be looking for things like a drop in asthma rates, that kind of stuff?
And in visible amounts of air pollution as well, and the feeling in the air.
Why has this not been done until now? And why only four cities kind of agreeing to it?
These four cities are showing leadership. Hopefully, the experiments that they make with policies and projects to phase out diesel vehicles will make it much easier for other cities around the world to emulate them without some of the costs of the learning process.
Yeah, and is part of the answer also that there's this new data on diesel that doesn't make it out to be as clean as we thought it was?
That's partially a factor, but we have known for a while that emissions from private vehicles and from trucks contributes to poor air quality. The information about diesel is just an added incentive on top of a growing body of evidence that, where possible, cities should promote public transport, cycling, and walking.
So for you as a researcher, Sarah, how big a piece of news is this that these four major cities are planning to ban diesel?
Well, I work on cities around the world on environmental issues, and it's really exciting to have these four mayors step up with this level of ambition and vision. And I hope they set an example to cities all over the world which are struggling with air pollution at the moment.
Sarah Colin-Brander, a researcher with the International Institute for Environment and Development in London. Thanks for your time today, Sarah.
Thank you very much.
I'm Marco Werman with The World. There are a lot of great opening lines in literature, but this one by the late Gabriel Garcia Marquez is among the best. Many years later, as he faced the firing squad, Colonel Aureliano Buendia was to remember that distant afternoon when his father took him to discover ice. That's the way Garcia Marquez starts the book, 100 Years of Solitude. The novel is a masterpiece of magical realism, a world where fantastical elements blend into reality. It's what Garcia Marquez is known for. But few realize that Fidel Castro played a part in those books, not as a character or inspiration, but as an editor. That's a word from Dr. Stephanie Panichelli Battaglia. She's a co-author of the book Fidel and Gabo.
Many people say that Fidel was an eager reader, that he would read all the time, and you would give him a book one night, and the next day he would have read it and would have excellent comments on the book and great, you know, constructive feedback on it. And so he even became one of the first reviewers sometimes of Gabo's book. So Gabo would give him a book to read before he would go to the publisher, for example. And then Fidel would come back with some corrections. Oh, he didn't know this, but that what you said here wouldn't be possible because of that. So it became really a friendship that was not just political.
That's extraordinary. I mean, I heard a rumor that Fidel was kind of a first draft editor for Gabo, but I'm wondering, specifically, is there one famous Fidel edit that you feel really changed the meaning of Gabriel Garcia Marquez's passage, at least, maybe even a chapter in a book?
No, I would say he would really have an eye for detail. Mm. So, for example, I'm just giving an example here. the characters in the book would, for example, use a gun for a specific scene or something like that. And then he would say, well, no, that's impossible because that type of gun wouldn't be used in that way, or you couldn't use it in with that specific bullet. Or,
wow.
You know, it's kind of these type of eye of detail that he really had and then would make those corrections to Gabo.
What do you think that says about Fidel Castro, that he can kind of zoom in on these details and kind of do those corrections?
Well, I think it confirms, again, what many have said, that, you know, he might have done whatever he did in Cuba with his government and his people and his society, but he was, without any doubt, a very smart person, and so definitely very reliable for this type of reviews, but also because he had that passion for literature, he was an ideal person to do that.
Amazing. Garcia Marquez kept up his support of Castro, even when other writers gave up on Castro. What did the support cost Gabriel Garcia Marquez?
Yes. You know, this relationship of Gabriel Garcia Marquez with Fidel has often been criticized, right? It was like a Nobel Prize winner that was supporting what some have called dictatorship. At an international level, people just did not understand what was behind that interest in keeping promoting Fidel. On the other hand, people have always clearly separated the Garcia Marquez as a person and the Garcia Marquez as an author. And it's not because, you know, some people might not have agreed with whatever he stood for politically that they stopped loving his literature. So in some, I wouldn't say that that had an impact on the success, the literary success he had. You know, it's such a long story and such a long friendship, and the first shock happened in 68, and then it continued happening, and people kind of got used to the fact that, well, you know, Gabriel Garcia Marquez writes amazing books, but he just is a supporter of the Cuban Revolution. And as I said before, people just make clear difference and distinction between these two people in one single person. His literature has never been directly linked to Cuba. So in some way, you can easily separate the one from the other.
Stephanie Panichelli Bataya, the co-author of the book Gabo and Fidel. Thanks for telling us about this. Really fascinating stuff.
Yeah, you're very welcome. Thank you for listening to me.
One thing is for sure, Gabriel Garcia Marquez was a singular writer, and his influence goes well beyond the printed page.
Vamos todos a bailar!
Gabriel Garcia Marquez is our inspiration.
That's Juancho Valencia. He's a keyboard player and conductor of the Colombian band Puerto Candelaria. Valencia says if sound could leap off the pages of 100 years of solitude and its imaginary town Macondo, then Puerto Candelaria would be the town band.
How is the sound of the books of Garcia Marquez? Puerto Candelaria is the sound of Macondo.
Juancho Valencia says it's a crazy sound. Valencia admits that as the band in the imaginary town plaza, Puerto Candelaria may come across as innocent, even naive. But in their music, he says, there's a lot of love and happiness.
This is Latin America, romance and crazy place. It's a good combination.
It is easy to hear a soundtrack to the magical realism of Gabriel Garcia Marquez in this. But let's remember that Puerto Candelaria come from Medellin, a city that used to be considered one of the most violent places in the world. So perhaps Puerto Candelaria have been able to pull their own kind of magical realism out of their hats, creating carefree and fun music, while living in a place where reality hasn't always been so fun. But don't think of the band's music as escapism, says Juancho Valencia.
Our music is not escape, it's a solution. The solution is the happiness. The solution is the humor, is the dance. No fight. Come on to dance.
Yeah. A musical take on magical realism courtesy of Colombia's Puerto Candelaria. They'll take us out today. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. The world's theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. We're back with you on Monday. Until then, have a great weekend.
PRI, Public Radio International.